Hi, and welcome to DC Public Safety. I'm Len Sipes. The show today focuses on the high-risk drug offender, and as you know, newspaper articles for the last 40 years have made this person a point of major concern. The question is whether or not the high-risk drug offender can be successfully supervised and treated. Can they become productive, crime-free citizens? To answer that question, we have two individuals on our first segment, one currently under supervision by my agency, the Court Services and Offender Supervision Agency, and one who has successfully completed supervision. They are Ronald Wade and Marissa Johnson. In the second segment, we will interview two supervisory community supervision officers who supervise and assist high-risk drug offenders on a daily basis. And with that, we welcome Ronald Wade and Marissa Johnson, and welcome to DC Public Safety.
Hi, how are you?
Hi, Marissa. Ronald, tell me a little bit about your backgrounds, your crime backgrounds and your drug backgrounds, because what we're talking about in this program is the person heavily involved in crime, heavily involved in drugs, and whether or not society can meaningfully do anything with these individuals besides incarcerating them. Marissa, go ahead, please.
My name is Marissa. Started using drugs at the age of 9. Stayed on the streets for 19 years, smoking crack. Choice of drugs was crack cocaine.
Oh, and at the age of 9, what did you start using?
Marijuana, PCP. I left from PCP to acid. After acid, crack cocaine.
Okay. And why do you think you started as early as you did?
I had abandonment issues.
I had what now?
Abandonment issues.
And what you're describing in terms of what we call the high-risk drug offender, that's not unusual.
No, it's not.
Early age of onset, early use of drugs, having family issues, that's common. It's common in the research, and it's common to all the offenders that I've talked to throughout my criminal justice career. Okay. So what about the crime part of it?
The crime part of it, it started at the age of 19.
Okay.
I got arrested the very first time for just giving a guy a ride. But he had PCP on him.
Okay.
But I got arrested also.
Right.
And after that, I copped a habit.
Crack
cocaine. It just was ongoing.
A lot of theft?
No theft. A lot of possessions.
Okay.
A lot of distribution.
Drug dealer?
Distribution.
Okay. You were caught up in that whole drug dealing world?
Distribution.
Okay. Violence is an inherent part of the whole drug dealing world, is it not?
Exactly.
Were you involved in the violence?
I seen a guy's head blow off a couple of times.
Okay.
In and out. Like I said, in and out, back and forth, until it got to the point where my last time, I didn't think I was going to come home.
When I talk to the community supervision officers within my agency who deal with the high-risk drug offender, they tell me in many cases it's like dealing with a person who has been a veteran at war. They've seen so many people hurt, so many people dying, so many people lives destroyed that they've become, you know, damaged in that process as people. Am I right or wrong?
It's so easy to get into, and it's still taking time for me to undo what I have done. Acceptance plays a big part of my life today, accepting the things I cannot change.
Okay.
C. Sosa has been wonderful to me.
Okay.
Absolutely, to the utmost. Without C. Sosa, I may be dead.
What programs are we talking about that you got involved in?
C. Sosa came to the D.C. jail to give me an opportunity to come back to the streets.
Okay.
At that time, I was still toxic.
Okay.
And I had no idea what I was signing. I had no sense of direction. All I know, I wanted to come to the street.
Right.
They gave me a chance and an opportunity to start my life over again.
All right.
Okay. I signed my name on a dotted line, not knowing what I was getting myself into.
Yep.
But when I met my probation officer, it was a book of a different color.
Yeah, I hear you. We want to get back to that and talk a little bit about that. But Ronald, your story, and when did you start drugs?
Probably at the age of 16.
At the age of 16? And what drugs were they?
Started out with alcohol.
Okay.
Graduated to marijuana.
Okay.
And then ran the table.
Right.
Every drug that was that you could conceive of, the hallucinogenics, marijuana, cocaine, heroin, but my drug of choice was labeled as heroin.
Okay. And your criminal background?
My criminal background is mostly dealing with property crimes and crimes against myself, distribution, you know, no violence involved.
Right.
Although I've been witness to countless occasions of violence taking place in the street and even in the institutions.
Yeah, and that's, again, a big part of when I talk to the community supervision officers, and this is the same question I posed to Marissa, when I speak to the community supervision officers who deal with a high-risk drug offender, they describe you guys as in many ways as almost as battle-scarred veterans, and that has an impact on your ability to escape this. So there's a certain point where the violence becomes almost accepted. There's a certain point where the violence and the disruption becomes almost a day-to-day thing.
When you're involved in the lifestyle of the street and from an institutional standpoint, you tend to become desensitized. I mean, you don't have the sensitivity that a normal human being has in relationship to how you feel as a, when a person is experiencing traumatic experiences in your life. In the institution, if you see an individual who is stabbed multiple numbers of times, your best outlook is to ignore that situation, mm-hmm. because you have to think past that situation.
Right.
If you decide to assist that individual, then the thing is you have to think, am I going to be the last person that he speaks to before he expires, so that whoever did what they did to him will come looking for me?
Okay.
So this is the street mentality that goes on. And I mean, it's dealing with the value system.
Well, and I agree with the value system, but let's get around to the programs a little bit. Marissa said that she was involved in programs through the Court Services and Offender Supervision Agency. Were you involved in any programs?
Yes, through C. Sosa. Thank God for C. Sosa and Mr. Brown at the South Capitol Street office,
mm-hmm.
because he made a determination with me that I had one or two choices. Either I could go into treatment or I could suffer the consequences of a warrant being issued.
Right.
Well, I didn't want to go to jail.
Right.
So I opted to take treatment. But in the process of taking the treatment, I was exposed to, you know, the different components that go along with the rehabilitation process. But what I had to do was make myself accessible and open to the information, because all the necessary components for a person to become crime-free and drug-free, CSOSA provides.
Okay.
I came through what was then known as AOC,
right.
Assessment and Orientation Center, and the therapeutic concepts from a psychological standpoint, from a health standpoint, from a spiritual standpoint, all of these things that I was exposed to and the information that was provided to me that would enable me to turn my life around. But I had to be willing to accept the information.
Well, and that's the problem. The problem is that in so many cases, when I talk to offenders who have successfully come away from a life of crime, mm-hmm. who are now working, who are now drug-free, who are now out, you know, they're tax-paying citizens. They're no longer a burden to society.
Exactly.
It is reaching that point where I've heard 100 times, 1,000 times from heroin addicts especially, I'm sick and tired of being sick and tired.
Exactly.
And when they reach that point, then they climb back through programs. But is there a way of reaching out to offenders who haven't reached that point? Obviously, you guys are not in your 20s, you're not in your teens, you've had some experience to you. Is a way of reaching out to the younger offenders to see if we can pull them out of the same cycle and get them involved in treatment and get them away from a life of violence and away from a life of crime? Is there a way of doing that? That's a tough question, I understand.
I have a daughter that's out there now.
She's out on the street?
She's out there.
She's part of the lifestyle?
She's part of the lifestyle.
Okay.
Prayer.
Yeah, prayer is right.
Pray.
I will say a prayer.
Prayer first.
I will say a prayer.
Prayer first. They say you can take a horse to the water, but you can't make him drink.
Right.
I have all the information. I use my information every day. I wear a tool belt when I walk out my front door.
You wear a what belt?
A tool belt.
Okay.
That I collected from Second Genesis as well as from C. Sosa.
Right.
It's fully loaded.
Right.
I strap up every day.
Right.
Looking for anything that may come my way. Because
right.
addiction is cunning and baffling.
Okay.
Okay. Acceptance. She's not ready.
Okay. And I hear that from so many offenders, and that's part of the tragedy in terms of dealing with high-risk drug offenders, of people who are out there doing a lot of drugs, doing a lot of crime, reaching out and pulling them back out of that pit, because all three of us know that it's a terrible, terrible pit to be in. It's one of the hardest things in the world to do until you're ready to make that transformation.
I'm on a tough love right now.
All right.
For my daughter.
Okay. Paul? Questions about reaching to those younger offenders?
The desire has to come from within. I mean, once the desire comes from within, then everything is already in place to assist an individual. But you can make the information available, but until a person is willing to access that information and make use of it, it's just out there.
Yeah. Now, we talked a little bit before the program. We didn't do a lot of preparation. I never do a lot of preparation with my guest on this program. I like it spontaneous. But we said, you know, the average person out there watching this show is going to say to themselves, wait a minute, you know, Ronald, Marissa, mm-hmm. You've done a lot of crime. You've done a lot of drugs. Hey, if we have money to give, let's give it to the school kids. Let's give it to the elderly. Let's plug it into schools. I don't want to give it to criminal offenders. They've done terrible things to themselves and to other people. Why should I
stop you right there?
Go, please.
The only way I keep what I have is to give back to the newcomer.
Okay.
That's every day.
Okay.
If it's just a phone call.
Right.
Like somebody did for me.
But explain that. You're giving back to who? The newcomer
is? The newcomer. The person that just has an hour clean.
Right.
Just that person. Just to say hello. Just to give you my phone number.
All right.
just to say we can do a movie together.
To maintain that connection, to pull that person out.
I have to give back all right. what somebody gave me.
All right.
Which was some words.
All right. So your response to all of this is that you're giving back. Right. You're out of that, and the programs are extremely important.
Very.
Okay.
Very. Very.
Ronald, the same question, and it's a tough question. I understand.
But it's a realistic question. But it has to be some type of input from a financial standpoint to finance these programs, because the problem is not going to go away. And if it's not addressed, you know, from the programs that's established, you know, through your agency and through other self-help agencies, you know, it's going to get worse.
How many people, well, I know the answer for myself, but for you guys, if those programs weren't there, the GED programs, the job placement programs, the mental health programs, the drug treatment programs, if these programs were just, you know, away, they disappeared, and all we did was supervise you guys, what would happen? And supervise people like you. All we did was supervise.
It'd be a lot of people still dying from this disease of addiction.
Okay.
It really would. I've had numerous of doors shut in my face because of my criminal background. Let's go back to that. But I had an excellent probation officer.
Right.
Bridget Nemo.
Okay.
That was the phone. Every time I called, she picked up.
Right.
I even interrupted a meeting down at the office one day because I needed to talk to her about what was going on in my life.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
It's that same thing of talking some, getting through it, you know.
Getting through it.
Okay. And I've had, all I asked was one day, just ask for a job.
Mm-hmm.
It's so hard for me to get employment.
Mm-hmm.
And I just maintained it. Getting the job that I really want. Because of my criminal background.
In answer to your question, the crime rate would skyrocket. If those programs that you just mentioned failed to exist, GED, job training programs, and help in self-help programs, the crime rate would skyrocket. Because you have an idle mind, and an idle mind is the devil's workshop. If you don't have anything constructive or positive to do, then you're going to regress back to what you're generally familiar with, which is the criminal element. I mean, that's the only way you see a survival, because that's the only way you know how to survive, is putting your criminal skills to work. And unless you have something to replace those skills from a constructive point of view, you will continue to do the same thing.
And I understand that, because, and I'm not quite sure the public understands it. I spoke to a woman one time who was deeply involved in drugs, deeply involved in crime, committed literally thousands upon thousands of crimes, if you count all the drug dealings and all the thefts. And that's what she said. I mean, she's now managing a business, and she's now has her home, and she's reunited with her kids, because so many kids are involved in all of this as well. And that's what she said, that if those programs disappeared, all it's doing is endangering the public. The thousands of crimes that she was committing, she's no longer committing. She's a taxpayer rather than a tax burden. And that was her point of view.
And that's the same as being homeless, in a sense. When you get a treatment, you don't have anything. You're homeless. You write down on your application you're homeless because you don't have your name on a lease anywhere.
Right.
And my question was, my biggest problem was when I got to Second Genesis, the last week of the program, I didn't have anywhere to go.
Right.
And I refused to leave out the door because I wanted to change.
Right.
So can I hold this bed? Can you call CSOS and ask them, can I stay one more week until I get some things lined up for myself?
Right.
Because, you know, you just caught up on the streets, and when you get clean, you're numb. You're still numb.
Right.
Really. And you don't have a sister's direction.
All right, and you've got the final word, Marissa and Ronald. Thank you very much for being with us on the first half. Look for us in the second half as we continue our discussion on the high-risk drug offender with two supervisory community supervision officers who supervise these kind individuals on a day-to-day basis. We'll be right back. Hi, and welcome back to DC Public Safety. I'm Len Sipes. Our next two guests in our discussion of high-risk drug offenders are supervisory community supervision officers. They are Elizabeth Estrell and Dorian Sanders. And ladies, welcome to DC Public Safety.
Hi,
all right, Elizabeth, the first question will go to you. You heard Ronald and Marissa's testimony, and you work with hundreds, if not thousands, of high-risk drug offenders throughout the course of a year. The story that they told, is this a typical story in terms of early onset of crime, early onset of criminality, the amount of drug use and the amount of crime that they commit?
Yes, it is.
Okay, tell me a little bit about that.
Well, I guess, you know, it's a vicious cycle. The population that I supervise are all under parole or supervised release.
Right.
So they have all served some period of incarceration.
Right.
Sometimes they've been in at least three or four times. They've done it before,
right.
It has not worked. So they're being released and are being supervised at a very high level.
Right. So you see them a lot. And when I say a lot, it could be, I mean, it's far more than what most parole and probation agencies throughout the country supervise offenders. You're in contact with them a lot. You drug test the dickens out of them. You've got them involved in programs.
Yes. Most of my offenders, actually, when they're released, they're all supervised in the intensive or the maximum level.
Right.
Which means I see them at least 3 times a week.
Right. And 3 times a week is phenomenal compared to most parole and probation supervision in the country. I just wanted the public watching this TV show to understand that.
Yes.
Okay.
They're required to drug test at least twice.
Right.
We do home visits at least once a month.
Right.
We do employment verification at least once a month. So we make sure that we have a very tight, close relationship,
right,
close supervision structure when they're first released.
Now,
to make sure that services that are being rendered to them are rendered and that they are complying, to make sure that they do what they need to do to stay home.
Okay. They're coming out of, in many cases, a program that we operate where they come out of prison and then they go into a building that we rehabbed in the District of Columbia, that is a giant rehabilitation center, where they come straight from prison to this building for 30 days of assessment and then in many cases go out to inpatient treatment.
Yes, sir. Most of my offenders come through the Reentrance Center. It's a new assessment center. It's in the grounds of DC General, the former DC General Hospital.
Mm-hmm.
They're there for 20-day assessment, a series of tests around. They look at the prior criminal history, the pre-sentence report, the reports from the institution. And after the 20-day assessment, they're plugged in. They can be in treatment 190 days.
Right.
120 days, 90 days, 30 days.
Right, but generally speaking, that's in-house treatment. It's not outpatient. It's in.
No, the assessment is for 20 a day.
Right.
After the assessment, then they're plugged into to treatment.
Right.
Yes.
But that treatment that they're plugged into after the 28-day assessment, that's basically, they stay at a location.
Exactly.
24 hours
it's
a day.
Inpatient.
Okay, inpatient.
Right.
Okay, cool. Yeah. Dorian, you handle what, correct me if I'm wrong, the probation population,
yes,
the
I
people,
do.
Not necessarily people who have been incarcerated, but in many cases they have incarceration in their backgrounds.
Right, they do have incarceration in their background. The program that I supervise, which is Star HIDA program, is a drug court program. And what we also provide is court sanctions for positive drug test results, failure to report for supervision. So once they come into our program through probation, through a judge, they go to court, the judge signs an order, they sign a contract agreeing to the terms of the program.
Okay.
They can be incarcerated for up to a maximum of 15 days,
okay,
depending on what the infraction is. If they fail to complete a drug treatment program, if they miss the urine test, they could possibly be sanctioned for 3 nights in jail. The second sanction for the same infraction, they would get maybe 7 nights in jail. And
so they know if they screw up, which, by the way, in terms of the public, people say, well, you know, the first drug test, let's throw them back in the prison. Well, if we did that, the prisons would explode tomorrow. We expect relapse. We expect problems from this population. So you're talking about the sanctions matrix where they understand every time that,
right,
they screw up, every time they give us a positive drug test, here's what's going to happen as a result.
Right, absolutely. And
okay.
I think what it also does, it helps them to see the relationship between their drug usage and the impact that it's having upon their lives, because they're constantly having to be interrupted by going back and forth into the prison system for even a couple of days.
Right.
So it has them thinking about, well, wait a minute, I think I need to do something a little bit differently because I'm going to be sanctioned.
Yeah.
Yeah, and possibly stepped back and revoked.
Now, how difficult is it, and either one of you can answer this question, both of you can answer this question, this is the toughest, roughest population that we have to deal with beyond maybe the mental health offenders. And a lot of your offenders bring mental health issues,
yes,
to the table,
exactly,
as well.
Yes.
I mean, you know, I've sat and talked with many community supervision officers who supervise this particular population. They like doing it. They like the challenge. They like being out there. But like supervising sex offenders, supervising mental health offenders, your population is one of the toughest imaginable, because you have to crawl into the lives of these individuals. And the stories that they tell in many cases are tragic in terms of the, you know, starting drug use at 8, 9, 10, starting crimes at 11, 12, 13, and in many cases going for decades in terms of this pattern. And suddenly, voila, you're there to try to pull them back out of a habit that they've been using for 10, 20, 30, 40 years.
For me, it's rewarding and it's challenging. Challenging because every day it's different. Every life is different. Every circumstance can be different. So I have to make sure that public safety is, you know, the public is safe.
Absolutely.
And I also have to make sure that the people that I'm in contact with, they're successful. Being successful to me means being productive, having a job, not using, you know, giving back to the community. Rewarding is, you know, the fact that after the end of the supervision period, that person, you know, is no longer, quote unquote, on papers.
Mm-hmm. Which means on supervision.
On supervision, yes. Rewarding to me means that, you know, D.C. is a safer place,
sure,
you know, for me and my family.
Of course.
And the fact that I can make a positive change in somebody's life, because I have a, you know, I think each person deserves an opportunity.
Right.
And I think that the agency has given a lot of BC residents that opportunity to succeed. We have an awesome responsibility. The people that I supervise, the charges range from murder, burglary. I mean, it's really high risk. Mm-hmm. In terms of it, I have a part of assisting in making my neighborhood safer.
Sure.
You know, is very rewarding.
Now, we should. You talked about success. We have two independent outside pieces of research from the University of Maryland that indicate that the individuals who go through the assessment center, the individuals who go through treatment, and then the individuals who are supervised by you and Dorian, they have dramatically lower rates of recidivism based upon new arrests. So obviously what you're doing works.
It does. It really, really does. And, you know, the studies show that when you have hands-on, when it's intensive, at least when the clients first come home,
mm-hmm.
you know, it usually turns out to be, you know, a better situation. Most people that are assigned to my team, they come kicking and screaming.
Yeah.
They don't want to be there.
That's right.
And, you know, I sit with them and I tell them what, you know, what my expectations are of them and what mm-hmm. theirs are, you know, of me. I'm here to provide a quality service.
Right.
And I'm going to do whatever I can to make sure that that is done. And if you can just take it one day at a time, if you can let me drive the car, okay, and be a passenger, I guarantee that it will be successful.
Dorian, same question goes to you in terms of the difficulty of dealing with this type of individual and what you do to cope and bring these individuals along?
I don't find this as a difficult task. I think when the offenders know that you're genuine and that you really care about their well-being and you're able to impart information to them that is very helpful. Even for those who may not be able to grasp what it is that we have to offer them, the fact that we're able to plant a seed, mm-hmm. whereas at some point in time during their life experience, maybe they'll be able to grasp what it is that we were trying to give them.
But I've done in a small way what you guys are doing in terms of gang counseling in the streets of the city of Baltimore, mm-hmm. the jail and job corps kids, and running a group in the prison system. For me, it was extraordinarily difficult. Their lives were so tragic in many ways, and dealing with their family, dealing with their kids, pulling them out was immensely taxing for me, and I found it difficult because I know how difficult their lives are going to be upon release and how many challenges they have. And quite frankly, without the resources that we have in CSOSA, so many of them went back to crime, so many of them went back to drugs. That's why I'm saying difficult.
Okay. I guess for me, I don't take it personal.
Okay.
I understand that this is their life experience.
Right.
And I also am aware of the fact that I can only do what they will allow me to do.
Right.
And that sometimes there are some experiences that people have to have that I have no control over.
Right.
So if they have to go back into the system in order to learn or to get what it is that they need in order for them to maybe be able to come out and be productive citizens, then sometimes that's what has to happen.
Well, I just remember in one particular instance, me and this guy's wife, we were screaming at him, you know, and saying, how in the name of blank can you do this after all the opportunities that you've been given? So, I mean, it's a tough field. I found it to be a tough field. Elizabeth, where do you think we should go in terms of supervising this sort of an offender? Do we have all the resources we need? We never claim that we have all the resources that we need, but programs do make a difference in the lives of these offenders, correct?
I think it does. I think the CSOSA is doing an awesome job, not only because I'm an employee of CSOSA, but because I have seen people's lives that have changed. I have seen families that have stayed together.
Mm-hmm.
So.
And a lot of them have children. A lot of these offenders have children, so it's just not them, it's their children as well.
Exactly. My clients, my team, is strictly adults,
mm-hmm.
but I deal with the entire family. Cause mm-hmm. we go to the homes,
right.
Whatever my clients have an issue with, I'm there, my officers are there. I have 9 officers that are
right.
assigned to my team and 1 assistant, and we're there to assist. So if the entire district, if all the teams were like my teams, I would think we'd be a lot better, but
Dorian, we only have a couple seconds left. Anything, the programmatic part of it? Because it's just not supervising, but it's just not drug testing, but it's assisting them as well.
I just think that we have a lot to offer. I think we're a unique agency compared to many other probation parole agencies throughout the country. And if we continue to bring in the programs and continue to improve upon them, the change will be just awesome in terms of how many people we'll be able to help and we'll be able to, you know, recover and be positive and productive citizens.
Ladies, thank you for being on the show.
Thank
and ladies and gentlemen, thank you for watching DC Public Safety. Look at our website for this and previous shows that we have, radio and television shows on the criminal justice system. Please have yourselves a very pleasant day. Mm-hmm.